1974, the year the Sears Tower opened, Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's home run record, and the last year there was an open Iowa seat in the U.S. Senate. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On this Politics Day, we discuss Senator Tom Harkin's announcement that he will not seek another term in 2014. We'll ask who are the possible contenders for his seat. Also, a possible breakthrough on immigration with a bipartisan framework for comprehensive reform. Our analysts today, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Justin Holmes of UNI. Politics Day on River to River starts right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's a snowy Politics Wednesday. Joining us on this day, Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University, not this time in our Des Moines studio. We've saved you that potentially hazardous trip. Dennis, thank you for joining us by phone.
I'm glad to be here, and I appreciate to do so.
Justin Holmes is with us, assistant professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, did make it into our Cedar Falls studio. Hi, Justin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for braving the weather and coming into our studio and being part of our show. Plenty to talk about. It's hard to believe sometimes when we have a weekly politics show that this much has happened within the course of just a week. We'll try to get to many of the top things coming at us this past week. Immigration, Harkin's retirement, his announced non-seeking of a next term, gun violence, discussions going on. You've heard that. Also, the confirmation of John Kerry. What are your thoughts? Join us during the hour, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's start with immigration. After years of inaction, gentlemen, immigration policy changing suddenly. Monday of this week, a bipartisan group of senators outlined their ideas for a bill that could move through the chamber, they say, as early as the spring. President Obama laid out his plan for immigration yesterday in Las Vegas. It was pretty much unchanged from the plan he touted on the campaign trail. The difference now, he says, is a sense of urgency surrounding the issue.
A call for action can now be heard coming from all across America. I'm here today because the time has come for common sense, comprehensive immigration reform. The time is now. Now, the good news is, for the first time in many years, Republicans and Democrats seem ready to tackle this problem together. Members of both parties in both chambers are actively working on a solution.
Some of President Obama's remarks on immigration reform yesterday in Las Vegas. That speech came on the heels of that bipartisan plan announced earlier this week from a group of senators. Arizona Senator John McCain was one of the senators involved in crafting that plan, which includes a pathway to citizenship for those currently in the country, undocumented workers. Senator McCain says his party can't afford to ignore the issue.
The Republican Party is losing the support of our Hispanic citizens. And we realize that there are many issues in which we think we are in agreement with our Hispanic citizens, but this is a preeminent issue with those citizens.
Dennis Goldford, what have we learned in these past, oh, say, 48 hours about this still evolving debate over immigration?
Well, nothing motivates a politician more quickly than the thought of losing office. And that's why we have the vote, to encourage those we elect to do what we want them to do and to punish those who don't do what we want them to do for that very reason. And Democrats, on the one hand, particularly President Obama, know that they owe their election, their reelection, to a great extent from support from the Latino community in the U.S. and those who sympathize with the particular issue of how we deal with the question of illegal immigrants. The Republicans are caught between those who are, like the senators you mentioned, Rubio and McCain and others, who are now trying, as President Bush and Karl Rove did 10 years ago, to take a more practical approach to the problem of illegal and undocumented immigrants. They're caught between that more practical approach and the Republican base, which is basically throw them out. They're here illegally. Their very presence here means they've broken the law. You don't have to say, well, they're here, but did they break another law? So it's a difficult nut to crack for Republicans. On the other hand, the Democrats are being held responsible and accountable for the kinds of promises they made.
Mm-hmm. Justin, I wonder if I can turn to you and ask you if you see potentially the pitfalls that might scuttle a deal, even though everybody's talking like this is almost a done deal, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there are a number of problems that could derail this, and I'm not entirely hopeful that something will actually end up coming out of this. There appears to be more energy for this in the Senate than there is in the House, although already since the initial announcement, Lindsey Graham has become sort of conditional that, you know, he would only support it if certain conditions were met, and whether those will satisfy him or not, we'll see. The bigger problem, though, is really the House, where, frankly, most of the Republicans in the U.S. House are in pretty safe districts, and they don't have that sort of electoral pressure from large Latino constituencies that might push them in that direction. And, in fact, it could be fairly politically dangerous for them to support that. And quite frankly, depending on what committee this would end up getting its first hearing in, you could see it scuttled there without even coming to a vote.
Mm-hmm. And some of the Republicans, and you alluded to this, Dennis, one sort of a, I think they used the word trigger to make sure that border enforcement comes before legalization. And that's also something that Congressman Steve King mentioned on this program yesterday, adamantly said that border enforcement comes before any discussion of a path of citizenship for undocumented workers.
The question is, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
You know, is it, you remember but George Aiken, it seems like 100 years ago, during the 1960s, late 1960s with Vietnam, he was, if I recall correctly, a senator from Vermont. He said, just declare victory and go home. And when you talk about border enforcement, again, the question is precisely, what do you mean by that?
Right.
And that itself will be subject to dispute. But I want to emphasize something Justin said, which is, again, in terms of the House, it's an issue that I brought up last time I was on this show, that, remember, you've got two different things to talk about when you talk about what nationwide opinion might be and what opinion might be in particular districts. And even in the state of Iowa, you know, the Congressman King does not have to care, unless he runs for Senate, which is another topic. But right now, he doesn't have to care in the least what people in Iowa who live in Congressman Latham's district think. You know, he's concerned with what people who live in his district think. The same with Congressman Braley in his district. And so whatever opinion might be overall nationwide, what matters to members of Congress who are representatives in the House, they're concerned with what their districts think, and we have relatively few mixed or moderate districts nowadays. Through gerrymandering and other such things, they're almost all overwhelmingly Republican or overwhelmingly Democrat, which doesn't lend to compromise.
President Obama, in talking about this week, says he will bring his own legislation to bear if Congress does not act quickly. How should we read that, Justin Holmes? Between the lines, President Obama applying pressure here? What is he really saying?
I think so. You know, it's a way, one of the powers that a president has is to really sort of set the national debate. You know, the presidency has a national sort of public opinion focus that no other office really does. And certainly his hope might be to sort of apply some pressure that way. At least in the schematics that we're seeing, I don't know how different, you know, his desires are from what the Senate has. But, you know, as the eight senators have said, you know, right now, these are just sort of some ideas. It's not a fleshed out proposal.
Dennis Goldford, can you elaborate on that anymore?
Well, you know, there's been some talk that's in essence a threat by the president to blame Congress if nothing gets out of there and he comes back with his own proposal. But also, you know, if President Obama is trying to conduct a more muscular presidency than many of his supporters thought he was doing in his first term, recall that to some extent, part of the difficulty for him, whether it was dealing with the economy or even elements of the stimulus and the Affordable Care Act and so forth. He basically said broadly, well, here's what I'd like you to do and go do something. In other words, he left an awful lot in the hands of Congress to work out, which resulted in a lot of things that were almost as distracting from his major concern. He was being more of the community leader, encourage others to take mm-hmm. leadership
so,
roles.
So you see this possibly a lesson learned by President Obama?
That's, at this point, a good guess, I think.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to another major political development on our landscape, especially for us here in Iowa. I want to put this in the form of a little pop musical quiz for the two of you. Let's do it this way. What political significance does the year that this song by Blue Suede was on the Billboard charts have?
Ooga chaka, ooga, ooga, ooga chaka, ooga, ooga, ooga chaka, ooga, ooga, ooga chaka, ooga, ooga, ooga.
I can't stop this feeling deep inside of me.
No, that was not debated in the House or in the Senate. That answer to that, 1974, Hooked on a Feeling, Blue Suede's version of that song. Our senators have certainly been hooked on a feeling, the feeling of being senators. In 1974, that was the last time we had an open race for a U.S. Senate seat in Iowa, and that's the answer. I didn't even give you either of you a chance to answer that. I was so excited about the answer, I bounced on it. I'm sorry. Well, it will happen again 40 years later, 2014, because Senator Tom Harkin has announced he will not seek another term in Congress. He has served in the Senate for Iowa since 1985. Some amazing statistics. Senator Harkin, together with Senator Charles Grassley, who started in 1981 in the Senate, have served together for almost 22,000 days, just over 60 years. And according to our research, it amounts to more side-by-side experience than any other state's current senatorial delegation. So who wants to fill that vacant seat, that open seat? Governor Branstad says no, he has no desire to do that. Dennis Goldford, who do you see on the list for the Democrats, perhaps, first of all?
Well, you know, on the Democratic side, there's been a lot of talk, and this is not news, recently about the possibility of Representative Braley running for statewide office. And prior to this announcement this past weekend, the thought was for governor. So he's certainly someone about whom there's been some talk for statewide office. And, you know, other than governor and senator, that's the only statewide. Well, I mean, certainly we have attorney general and we have secretary of agriculture and so forth. But in terms of the predominant or the preeminent statewide offices, it's governor and senator. So Braley, certainly. We haven't heard that about Dave Loebsack. There were some rumors or talk about the possibility of former Governor Culver wanting to run for governor again, but there used to be talk when he was running for governor that his ultimate desire was to go back to the Senate, just as his father did. Now, that was just talk way back when. So I think he would be a possibility. There was the third I can't think of at the moment.
What about the idea of reaching back to a earlier former Iowa governor, current Secretary of State? Was that
right.
The third one?
Well, no, it was Tom Vilsack, I was thinking. I mean, Vilsack, yeah. Of course, you know, it helps if you're going to run for higher office either to be in another office at the moment or to have won your last election. And Tom Vilsack is both in office as Secretary of Agriculture for the country and won his last election, his reelection to governor. That makes it a little tougher for Chet Culver since he lost that reelection race for governor. I don't know if Tom Vilsack wants to leave Washington. He's very much of a policy wonk. He loves that stuff. On the other hand, there's a four-year limit. There's a clock ticking on that particular position.
Mm-hmm. Let's go over to the GOP side and hand it to you, Justin. Who do you see vying for this seat from the GOP? Possibly. Branstad has said no.
Branstad said no. Kim Reynolds had a similar statement that really she wanted to focus on state politics.
Lieutenant governor?
Lieutenant governor, yep. Steve King is really the first one that comes to mind for me. It's probably the most prominent that seems to be playing with the idea, at least. Although I have a little skepticism about how well he plays statewide. He's been very successful in his district, but he's also tremendously conservative, and I don't know if he would be a viable statewide candidate or not.
Mm-hmm. Tom Latham also mentioned as a name there. Dennis Goldford, when we talk about potentially a primary in the GOP to run for this seat, Steve King versus Tom Latham, do you think it would really come down to a primary between recognized more moderate in the GOP versus the self-described constitutional conservative King? Would it come down to a primary, or would they decide this within the party?
That's the interesting question, because they certainly didn't want a primary to run in the new 4th district. It escapes me which district Congressman King is representing now. But
he's in the 4th, the new 4th. Okay, Tom Latham in the new 3rd.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And so they didn't want a primary. You know, Congressman Latham moved from outside of the new 3rd district into the 3rd district so he could run from there. They didn't want a primary then. I can't see on the one hand, you know, primaries are like fights within the family. They can get very nasty. On the other hand, you do have a bit of a division in the Iowa Republican Party. It got tamped down a little bit in this past race, but we certainly saw it in the 2010 gubernatorial race. You do have a particular division between those who are more concerned with social and religious conservative kinds of issues, and that's certainly Steve King and the Tea Party, and those more establishment, if not country club and mainstream and corporate Republicans. There's a potential conflict there.
Mm-hmm. Thinking back, that this is really – is this an anomaly? Let's go back to that 1974 reference again, the last time Iowa had an open U.S. Senate seat, 1974. 40 years will have passed before we have that happen again in 2014. Let's think about how far back 1974 is. Caitlin Fry, or one of our assistants here, helped me out with some memories of 1974. The speed limit was lowered to conserve gas. Remember that? Gerald Ford, of course, president, still in the aftermath of Watergate. Patty Hearst kidnapped. The Sears Tower opened. As a kid, Dennis, you may have played Sock'em Rock'em Robots. Did you do that?
Oh, I was just a child back then.
Well, right, yeah. Rock'em Sock'em Robots is a child's game.
I was actually in graduate school. And remember, there were basically 4 networks at the time. ABC,
right.
NBC, CBS, and the relatively new public broadcasting system.
Yes. Sonny and Cher were broke up. Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's home run record, 715 home runs. So it has been such a long time. How is it this question also discussed with Senator Grassley yesterday on this program, that Iowa can reelect senators, these two senators again and again, who are at opposite ends of the political spectrum, Dennis?
Well, I heard that interview and I thought, oh, good, Senator Grassley is going to talk about that. And he, in a sense, said what I've been saying for quite some time when people from out of state ask me about that. I say that, you know, how can the same state elect Tom Harkin and Chuck Grassley? And I've said there are just some things we're not meant to understand. But both are very good retail politicians. Both manage to maintain their connection to Iowans very well. That may be their personalities, but I think also when they saw Dick Clark not reelected in 78, and when they saw that was by Roger Jepson,
right.
And then Senator Grassley beat John Culver in 1980. One of the charges, I wasn't in Iowa then, but I remember in terms of the national press, one of the main charges was these were guys who were more interested in national issues and forgot the folks at home, or at least the folks at home believed that these guys had forgotten the folks at home. And Senator Harkin and Senator Grassley have been wonderful grassroots retail politicians maintaining that contact in an ongoing sense that Iowans demand.
Mm-hmm. Any other further ideas on that, Justin?
Well, I think, you know, other states have had split delegations as well. And I think, you know, that sort of personal connection and connection to the local issues really helps. The other thing is there is a very strong incumbency advantage in Congress. That is, you know, folks that stand for reelection tend to get reelected. So, you know, even if it were just kind of a complete random fluke, you know, that each got elected in the first place, not saying that it was, but even if that were the case, then it wouldn't be surprising to see each of them get reelected again.
Mm-hmm. But you know, they've been reelected in very different ways. Senator Grassley beat Senator Culver, I think, with something in the low to mid 50 percentile range. He's never had less than 60% of the vote in any reelection ever since. Oftentimes it was close to 70, certainly above 65, closer to 60 this last time. Senator Harkin gets reelected, but he's always had tougher reelection races. He's been reelected, generally speaking, with the low to mid 50% range.
I wonder, when we think about the person to fill this seat, does the Democratic or Republican Party have an advantage in terms of a better apparatus or infrastructure to field the strongest candidate? Thoughts on that?
You know, I think one thing to think about here is the national context. And, you know, in general, midterm elections are not great for the president's party. And, you know, this, I think, presents a bit of a challenge for the Democrats here because, you know, it's a year that we're probably set up to actually have some Republican gains where there are potentially open seats. You know, the Obama campaign is perhaps the finest political apparatus to sort of roam the face of the earth in terms of getting people turned out. But how much of that spills over into the actual Democratic machine? You know, it was a separate entity, so it's a little harder to say.
Let me add quickly mm-hmm. that independently of the president being the incumbent here and the president's party, is that in midterm elections, we saw to a great extent in 2010, but it's happened before, your average Democratic voter is less likely to vote in the midterm election than your average Republican voter. So the fact that this is going to occur in a midterm election gives a certain advantage to Republicans unless Democrats can turn out their people much better than they did in 2010.
Before we go to break, Troy is with us from Iowa City. You have a suggestion for who you'd like to see run for senator in Iowa?
Yes, I do. I would like to see Jim Leach. I talked to him, and I'm a kind of a Republican, and he somewhat endorsed Obama, but I think he's the best guy for the job, actually. Jim Leach.
Okay,
people should talk to him.
Thank you, Troy. Throw that name out. Of course, Jim Leach reelected many times in a very liberal corner of Iowa, or one of the most liberal corners. Dennis?
Well, I can't recall what he's doing right now. He's got a position of doing something, and my guess is he's enjoying it.
Yeah.
But especially since, as a Republican, he's somebody, if the caller's right, that he did support President Obama, that's a kiss of death among Republicans.
Okay. We want to continue our talk here on Politics Wednesday. Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University, joining us this hour. Also with us, Justin Holmes. He's assistant professor of political science at the University of Iowa. When we come back, we'll talk about the continuing debate over gun violence and President Obama's proposals, how that political debate is developing. Also, the Obama cabinet in his second term, confirmation of John Kerry by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee just yesterday. What will Hillary do if she's not roaming the earth as the Secretary of State? We'll talk about that when we come back. Change in filibuster rules and maybe some other things we'll talk about. We're hooked on politics today on River to River, of course, as our senators have been talking about the longevity of our senators in office. Senator Harkin announcing that he will not seek another term. We'll be back with Dennis Goldford and Justin Holmes. Perhaps a comment or a question from you. 1-866-780-9100.
I can't stop this feeling deep inside of me. Girl, you just don't realize what you do to me when you hold me.
So nice to have you with us on this snowy Wednesday, Politics Wednesday here on River to River. We know great herds of bison once roamed Iowa, but did you know much further back in time there were woolly mammoths, mastodons, and giant sloths? Tomorrow on this program, I'll be talking with William Clark of Iowa State University about animals that have disappeared from our landscape in the recent past 200 years. Then Holmes Semkin of the University of Iowa will be here. He'll talk about creatures that inhabited Iowa, this very place on the planet, the last ice age, tomorrow on the program. Today, politics, discussing the immigration proposal, bipartisan proposal put out by a group of senators. Also, the announcement by Senator Harkin that he will not seek another term when he's up for re-election in 2014. And if you want to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. We want to talk about the debate over gun violence as we continue into this second half hour. President Obama's proposals about gun violence that stemmed out of that gun violence task force that he set up. Former Representative Gabrielle Giffords spoke this morning at the start of the Senate Judiciary Committee's first hearing on gun violence prevention. She's urging the panel to take action on gun safety. Here she is.
This is an important conversation for our children, for our communities, for Democrats and Republicans. Speaking is difficult, but I need to say something important. Violence is a big problem. Too many children are dying. Too many children. We must do something. It will be hard, but the time is now. You must act. Be bold, be courageous. Americans are counting on you. Thank you.
Former Representative Gabrielle Giffords speaking this morning. Giffords not on the list of witnesses released in advance of the hearings of the Senate Judiciary Committee's first hearing on gun violence prevention. She showed up at the hearing this morning with her husband, former astronaut and retired Navy Captain Mark Kelly, guiding her in and out of the hearing. Giffords, you hear there, still struggling with her speech and her walking after being one of 19 people shot in Tucson, Arizona in 2011. Earlier this week, the president met with law enforcement officials hailing from communities affected by the high-profile shootings, Tucson, Newtown, Aurora. He stressed the importance of reaching consensus with Congress to advance his gun violence proposals. And Dennis and Justin, he ticked off proposals in that list, including passing laws that restrict the access and availability of assault weapons, magazine clips that aren't necessary, he says, for hunters and sportsmen, universal background checks, also mentioning issues of mental health, school safety. Dennis, what if any of these proposals by the president and his gun control task force look like they have a chance?
You can see from the range of emotions that this issue raises that this is a really hard matter to deal with. There's possibly something that can be done with regard to background checks. But in terms of, given the structure of Congress, the lobbying power of the National Rifle Association, the incredible intensity of those opposing any kind of restriction on gun rights, we have a system where people of higher intensity, even if they're not a majority, can win over people of lower intensity who might be a majority. But it's hard to see how much of anything beyond possibly some way of strengthening background checks is going to occur.
Justin, your thoughts?
I think the background checks would be the most likely to pass. If you look at public opinion polling, something close to 90% of Americans would basically support strengthening that. And that includes a majority of gun owners and I believe even a majority of NRA members. The basic premise there is that, you know, we can identify some people that we don't think have guns or should have guns. And that, frankly, we don't do a very good job of that right now. We have this system where if you buy through a dealer a new or used gun, then that gets a check. But something like 40% of transactions don't go through that. Private citizens in most states can sell each other guns, and there's no they don't even have to verify age. And I think most people have a bit of a problem with that. So I think that one has some likelihood of passing. I think the a new assault weapons ban is a much more much less likely to pass than that. And kind of ditto for some of the other proposals. Mm-hmm.
Mary is joining us from Iowa City on this topic. Mary, you have something to chip in. Thank you for joining us on River to River.
Thank you for taking my call. Well, I don't see that Obama's calling for gun control. He's calling for gun limitation. Now, we have the case of the Thompson submachine gun. Remember the Tommy gun, Al Capone wiping out half of Chicago and so forth?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you could buy a Thompson submachine gun, but the barrel had to be welded. And when we talk about the Second Amendment and the right, it's two readings to the Second Amendment, because that comma by after militia gives it one reading. Or if you, you know, take out the parenthetical clause, it gives another meaning. And Kevin Phillips' new book, 1775, goes into why we have this. Because during the United States didn't have any money to fight England, Britain, whatever you want to call it. So they were broke. So they depended on the people buying their own arms. And the economy didn't get back on its feet until 1790. So, and then we have the preamble to our Constitution,
right,
that we have to preserve our liberty for our posterity. Now, if our kids keep on getting murdered in school with these weapons, we don't have a future. And, you know, it goes on and on and on, but assault weapons only meant to kill one type of animal, and that's a human being.
Mary, thank you very much for your call from Iowa City, 1-866-780-9100. I wonder if Dennis, if you see the pressure as time goes by, the pressure to take some action against gun violence fading, as names like Sandy Brook, however horrific, fade in the headlines.
They will fade. I mean, you can say fortunately or unfortunately, depending upon your point of view, but it will fade, and I think Sandy Brook's already faded, even as you can still...
Sandy Hook, I'm sorry, I misspoke.
I hope I spoke correctly. you can see that it's already faded in this regard. In regard to what the caller suggested, you know, you could argue about the militia clause, but and the Supreme Court sometimes will overturn a previous ruling. But for right now, in the Heller decision a couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court said, and that was a 5-4 decision, and you can argue they were right, and you could argue they were wrong, depending, as the dissenters did, depending upon your point of view. They said that the Second Amendment does guarantee an individual right to own weapons independently of militias. Now, at the same time, we have to remember, and this extends to the Second Amendment and really all of our rights, and as strange as this will sound, no right is absolute. The question is, what standard does government have to meet in order to infringe upon a particular right? So we talk about freedom of speech, but in the classic example, your freedom of speech can be impinged upon if you're yelling fire falsely in a crowded theater. So you have the argument on the part of some pro-gun right groups that the rights are absolute. But none of our rights are absolute. But still, you can argue that there's certainly a compelling interest government must demonstrate if it's going to limit any of our particular rights.
Dennis Goldford with us of Drake University. Justin Holmes with us of the University of Northern Iowa. Let's go to Mike in Fairfield, who's listening and wants to talk about the gun violence discussion. Mike, hi. Welcome.
Hi. How are you?
Doing just great. What do you want to chip in here?
Well, okay. I think the reason why our country has such amazing amounts of gun violence compared to other countries is simply because of the war on drugs. We have such a huge amount of money in the black market, and gangs and all these. These are the folks that contribute to the majority of gun violence. I'm very surprised that no politician or media personality has even mentioned the very violent consequences of the war on drugs. And also, the Federalist Papers, in numerous occasions, point out that individuals protecting themselves from any intruders, be it government or whatnot, you know, that's why we do have the Second Amendment. Thank you.
Mike in Fairfield, thank you for that question. Let's move on. We want to get to a couple of other topics here. The retooling of the Obama cabinet here in the beginning of his second term. After 28 years in the Senate, one failed presidential bid and 4 years as chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, John Kerry formally confirmed yesterday to succeed Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. Kerry sailing through the Senate confirmation process in a matter of days. He received a near unanimous approval from his colleagues for the job. Kerry could be sworn into office as early as this Friday. What can we expect from Kerry? Any ideas on that, Justin?
I don't know that it'll be a giant departure from Secretary of State Clinton, to be honest. They occupy a fairly similar ideological position. And, you know, he does have tremendous tremendous experience here. He's been on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for a number of years. And from what I'm hearing, you know, he's somewhat pragmatic in his approach, but I don't know that he'll be radically different than what we've seen so far.
Dennis, does he see the world, the U.S.'s place in it, diplomacy in the world, differently than Secretary Clinton?
I think I agree with Justin. It's hard to see a lot of daylight right there. Senator Kerry, of course, we recall, was attacked by conservative independent groups during his 2004 race for the presidency as not having done the things in Vietnam that he claims to have done, and most people, I think, recognize that he has done. So he said, you know, he did that famous speech, "Who wants to be the last man to die?" To get out of a particular war, especially one as controversial as Vietnam. But I don't think he's that dovish necessarily. But, you know, he'll give his recommendations to the president in various foreign policy matters, but ultimately the president will decide, and Kerry's job, as it was when he was in the military, is to salute and say, "Yes, sir."
Secretary of State, current Secretary of State until John Kerry will be sworn in. Hillary Rodham Clinton, hoping to spend her last days in the cabinet post traveling the world, but health concerns have grounded her for that moment. So she did the next best thing. She did a virtual world tour. She participated in a global town interview at the museum in Washington, D.C. She fielded questions from around the globe. Many asked her about her future plans and whether she will again seek the presidency. In an interview with NPR's Michelle Kalman, Clinton was asked what questions she needed to answer for herself before making a decision about running in 2016.
I'm not even posing those questions. I am really looking forward to stepping off the fast track that I've been on. You know, I've been out of politics as Secretary of State. I don't see myself getting back into politics. I want to be involved in philanthropy, advocacy, working on issues like women and girls that I care deeply about. I want to write and speak. I want to work with my husband and my daughter on our mutual foundation interests. So I'm going to have my hands full, and I have no other plans besides that.
Okay, maybe we know some of the plans. Justin, you or Dennis, do you know any plans for Hillary Clinton that she might not be mentioning at this point, Justin?
Well, it sounds more like she's been thinking about it than she said in her initial response to the question. It's hard to say. You know, the Clintons have really not gone away from the spotlight particularly, and certainly she's run once, and there would be a temptation to run again. You know, any poll that I've seen for 2016, and as hard as it is to believe people are already polling for 2016, you know, she's far and away the favorite of Democrats, although that's without, you know, anybody else being considered. But it is possible that she's just ready to hang up the electoral politics at this point. I mean, she's had a pretty remarkable career in many ways, and perhaps she's just ready to move on, like she says.
Possibly ready to hang up her career in politics. Do you agree with that, Dennis?
Her reputation will never be higher than it is right now. And, you know, she'd be another 4 years older, roughly, trying to take a second run. And, you know, Americans tend not to be that forgiving anymore of people who run at least once and fail that first time. But still, she has tremendous name recognition, more than almost anybody beyond the president at this point. And I think that the problem for the Democrats is that once you look beyond Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, there's nobody who stands out as an obvious contender. Now, somebody will, and several people will, make themselves such. But for right now, it's partly because there's a bit of a vacuum for the Democrats.
Also yesterday, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, a former lawmaker from our neighbor, Illinois, and the last Republican left in President Obama's first-term cabinet, announced he was stepping down once a replacement was confirmed. I guess among those mentioned as a possible successor, Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, whose second term ends in June. Back to, of course, John Kerry leaving the Senate leaves that with a temporary replacement there until there's another election there. I believe Scott Brown leading the polling in Massachusetts, the Democrats having a somewhat more comfortable majority in the Senate than they did prior to this last November's election. But also other actions in the Senate. Perhaps, Dennis, you can tell us about the filibuster rules. They've been reformed, passing through the Senate this last week, the bill receiving mostly bipartisan support, 52 Democrats, 25 Republicans, including our Senator Charles Grassley, approving the plan to limit filibusters, though I understand moderately limiting. In what ways?
Moderate may be a bigger word.
Than it's really due, huh?
Right, right. I mean, the Republicans, I think, if I recall exactly, I mean, it was so moderate that it was easy to miss. But I think they agreed that they would limit the occasions, for example, of filibustering for judicial nominees below the level of the Supreme Court, as opposed to the Supreme Court. They didn't compromise anything there. And the Democrats have agreed to allow the Republicans, the minority, to pose amendments in ways they hadn't been able to do so before. But the broader issue is this, that the House is a majoritarian institution. The majority runs things, and the minority is pretty helpless. Republicans spent 40 years in that wilderness, and they've been trying to make the Democrats pay for that ever since, and that's understandable. On the other hand, the Senate is a minoritarian institution because of the filibuster. The problem is you don't have somebody taking the floor and speaking for 48 hours anymore and holding the floor the way it used to be. All you used to do is just threaten the filibuster, and the Senate says, okay, well, we won't talk about that issue. And what the majority wanted to do, at least for a while, was say, okay, if you want to filibuster, you've got to do it. The problem is that every senator knows that majority or minority, Democratic senator or Republican senator, there may come a point at which you want to make use of that privilege yourself. And so you're hesitant to take it away from everybody because that takes it away from you too.
I wonder if this very limited change in filibusters will change the process in the Senate and make it less like, well, shall we say, molasses in January?
Well, I think the issues in which the filibuster matters most will not change. And the issues where it matters less, that's perhaps where the change will have an impact.
A quick comment from the two of you on this topic. This week, some high-profile Republicans are saying it's time to stop fighting against same-sex marriage. One, the former Massachusetts Governor Romney's campaign advisor, another someone who engineered George W. Bush's successful 2004 re-election campaign, speaking earlier at a gathering in Iowa this week. I wonder, Justin, do you see how do you see this issue developing in the GOP in the coming months and years, now that we're seeing more Republicans coming out and saying, you know, this really does fit with conservative ideas about freedom. Why not be free to marry any person you love?
Yeah, you know, this has been a really interesting interesting issue. I've hardly seen anything in public opinion move so quickly, to be honest. And it's both sort of a generational change and, you know, even older voters changing their minds on the issue. And it is something that the Republican Party is going to have to come to terms with. Andrew Sullivan, for example, wrote, probably 25 years ago now, an article called The Conservative Case for Gay Marriage that basically, you know, laid out that same set of principles that, you know, this is a small government issue. And if you don't want invasive government, then it has to apply everywhere. But there are some real difficulties for Republicans going down that road, especially, you know, if we think back to sort of the issue of Republicans and primaries that we talked about before, which is that a number of Republican primary voters would be just vehemently opposed to you know, any moderation on this issue. So it's really there's a real tension between sort of the Republican base and, you know, the possibility of building a majority in an election around that issue.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, we have just a half a minute or so left. Your view on how this issue, same-sex marriage in the GOP, will develop?
If it's going to develop, it's going to take time. Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council, Rick Santorum, unsuccessful attempt to Republican presidential nominee, they speak for a pretty powerful constituency within the Republican Party.
Okay. And over the weekend, Republicans gathering in Charlotte for the RNC's winter meeting. Anything jump out about that for you, Dennis, quickly, then we'll go.
Sure. I think I've made the claim for quite some time that the usual way to respond to a series of electoral defeats, as in the case of the Republicans lately, is to deny there's anything wrong with your message. It's to claim you're just not getting your message out. So there's no attempt to reexamine what they're saying. They're coming out saying we've got to say it better to more people.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University, Justin Holmes, assistant professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Thank you both so much for joining us this hour.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry in Cedar Falls. Help from Tony Daner. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk show is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.